Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got!
Listen.
Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's L.A. crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Do you guys know how this works?
Yeah.
I think so.
I want to keep that in. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me, the two that are responsible for this ongoing craziness.
Well, future legal responsibilities, we waiver all right.
So the two that both plied me with booze and secondarily got really in my face about what I actually wanted to do with my life are right here to join me again, my two near and very dear friends, Mr. Stu Coote and Mr. Garth Franklin. Gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute.
Thank you. And thank you. I have no business being here. Have you seen the guests that have been on this show recently?
I know, I feel like so underqualified.
No, you do. You should be here. If you shouldn't be here, then I've got no chance. I'll just show myself out. I don't even know how I got on here. I'm happy to be here now.
You're stuck in the back door, don't worry. Yeah. I do it all the time.
Yeah.
People keep starting off with the first episode, that very first episode with you and I, and they keep going.
Yeah, well,
they're still
that's
here.
A book. That that's first episode book. Of entire blackness.
You know? Yeah.
And then you abusing me about getting all black, like 30 seconds of all
blackness. I like to set the tone for any podcast I'm on.
Just hurling abuse at me. Look, guys, it's the 130th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat, and what do I do with guests? Sometimes I give them minutes that I know they're excited to talk about, I know that they're thrilled to talk about, I know that they're desperate to talk about, and I know 100% that Stu and probably Garth don't give a shit about this particular moment of Heat. So I thought it would be a really interesting experiment. We've got Edie here, and we've got Neil, and we've seen the fallout, the previous scenes that you would have been hearing about. Sort of Neil wrangling Edie in this glorious sunrise.
World's worst Tinder date.
The world's worst slow motion run up a hill that was never going to get away.
Can I leave yet?
And now,
the pinkest LA sunset I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
It does not happen.
It's like glorious. Dante Spinotti invented that sunset in LA, which is absolutely glorious. But you get this moment where now in like the literally cold, lighter day, is Neil trying to make peace with the fact that he's imprisoned this person that he's been lying to himself about for some time.
Yeah, it's not one of my favourite parts.
No,
it's not the arc pleasant. Coming down.
Because it's nasty.
Coming
down.
It is nasty. It's also partly because she's like probably the most sympathetic character in terms of just...
And I still, once we'll hit the minute, but I still think this kind of comes out of nowhere. And I think it's a bit odd.
Let's dive into that because there's some in rewatching, and I think we'll cover it in a minute. In rewatching this, in 2019, the three of us, are particularly, and all you guys listening, are so accustomed to the bombardment of media And I just think that, like, circa LA 95 is a very interesting technological time for news. Like, it was literally, they invented that sort of car chase TV at this time.
If it,
you know,
if
that,
it bleeds,
if
it bleeds.
If it bleeds, it leads. 24-hour news cycle, you know.
OJ was like 2 or 3 years before this.
No, no, OJ's this year.
Was this year?
Yeah, it's like in, this is an
oh, so it's 2 or 3 years after the riots.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years after the riots. It's an OJ world. And so as the heat that we're appraising here, we've seen Edie, Amy Brenneman's character, in a previous scene, just like glued to a television. She's had 3 dates with a guy that she might be going away with. She thinks it's a holiday. She doesn't know it's a permanent come away with me for everything.
Glued to a television, that massive television on little tray there.
Yeah, well, she's glued to a television that for 24 hours has been showing the guy she slept with twice.
Yeah,
has murdered people.
That's the Ralph model of that TV.
That's all 12 inches of it?
Yeah. It's a big model. So what we're going to do is we're going to check out this minute. You guys know the drill. We're going to watch this minute together, and then we're going to come back and talk about it with two guys who have talked about it with me on the show more than anyone else alive. Here we go.
There's some cash.
When's it over?
22 hours from now. Then we get out of here clean.
When will you let me leave?
Go now. You went out, there's the door.
Will you let me leave later?
It will be different. Do you understand?
It's such an interesting scene to watch when you know that literally in the next 2 consecutive minutes is the Ralph scene. The infamous Xander Berkeley Ralph scene. Because you're seeing in this moment an opportunity for their relationship to be apart, and Neil is still... I kind of feel it's like there's kind of two Neils. There's this fantasy Neil, just like this fantasy escape almost, that defies his programming. And he's like trying to reconcile
that with the
impulse Neil and fantasy Neil together in this scene. And
this is the breaking of his every fiber of his discipline. Breaks in this minute where he's paying someone off who's, he hasn't let anyone that close to him in what, years? You don't get the sense, he says he has a girl in every port, but
it's always a tertiary concern more than anything.
I think this is as close as he's let someone get for a while. You get that sense, because you know, there's probably a bad version of Neil that kills her, potentially.
Yeah, this is the thing.
He's a violent person.
This is the thing that's come up. I think it's only in that tension, which is what's great about the character, why we still actually like him, is the tension between what we know he's capable of and who he wants to be. And it's that, like, so it's that same tension that Vincent has in a way. It's like Vincent really does genuinely want barbecues and ball games. Like, he wants to be able to live a family life where he can still participate, but he's, you know, he's like a bloodhound. As soon as these guys come in, he's like, I'm here, I'm present, this is where I'm hyper alive. Like, this is where I'm most me in those moments. And it's the same with Neil. So right now, it's
Macaulay's not that. Macaulay's not Hannah.
No.
He doesn't want the ball games and all that.
Well, I don't know. Well, I don't know what his life's like in New Zealand. If it's a quiet, if it's an unassuming guy who just buys a house and...
Hey, James Cameron could do it.
No, but I wonder if, like, he would then establish that regular lifestyle. Kids, family.
I just imagine, I can imagine, like, a Taika Waititi kind of guy going, are there any hotline burglaries that have mystified us? Because
Have locks.
he's going to go and steal New Zealand. It's just done. The GDP is over.
Gonna hoodwink everyone.
that type wouldn't. I mean, as much as they can probably delude themselves into thinking that they can. It's like, as you said, he doesn't want to do much of anything else.
He's going to sit there and just start casing as soon as he hits the ground. But I don't know if this scene necessarily robs her of her agency or she gets it back when she's asking, because it very quickly goes from here, leave, her saying, no, can I go later? Can I stay on this ride?
Yeah. Feel free to leave her house, by the way.
Yeah, by my own choice. Like, he's paying her off going, look, here's the money. Just, it's not exactly hush money, but it's kind of the payoff.
Like, it's like, finish what you've got to finish to close all your doors so we can get the hell out of here.
Yeah, and she's going, but will you let me go? I mean, he's still got the control, and it's really interesting from going from...
Oh, it's all dictated on his terms. Yeah, well, absolutely.
And especially the standing over her while he's got the cash, to then again, we've talked about this before, of getting down in characters' eye lines.
Yes. Yeah.
There's that restraint in him, though, that every time I come on the show, I keep saying I ebb and flow between who I like, Pacino or De Niro. Yeah. And there's these moments like where you know De Niro is about to be a volcano that never goes off, whereas Pacino is constantly going. He constantly is. He's like the angry chef that keeps bursting.
Pacino impulse control could learn. De Niro,
De Niro is the coiled spring that just starts to move just a little bit. But I don't know in terms of her agency. If it's there or if she's just another commodity, getting treated like another one of the sort of the heat wags, as it were.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I am deeply still conflicted about it. And I think it's like...
It feels... It's uncomfortable, a scene.
Deeply uncomfortable scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the more raw scenes of the entire film for me when I watch it. Because also, you know, when he says... And this is where I think the conflict starts from. And I think it's the purity of what Michael Mann has designed in the character of Edie, which we, you know, people have trouble with. And I think it's also her take on the character, which is she wants to believe him.
Yeah.
Like, she's ready for a relationship. She sees this guy, like Mr., you know, nice, Mr. Romantic. Yes, he's a bit fleeting. They've had a couple of dates. But I think everyone sort of gets a bit like... imagines they've been together for some time and then she just like wildly believes him. Like, this is literally the third date. The third date is him storming into her house after she's been watching him kill people all day.
And she's got no reason up and... like, there's not even... because we see canned violence from him in this.
Yeah, yeah.
The cocked arm.
She has, so she has no idea if
she's never seen
it. She's never seen it.
The worst she's got, and I know, like, the Neil got... there's been times when people chastise him for the booty call, which I still don't think is a bit of a booty call after the dinner.
After the dinner, there's...
he wants that life.
Yeah, he wishes that like, he was his life.
The closest he's got is like, I think there is something there with this girl. I think I can steal it. He's a thief.
I think I can
steal her as much as I've cased everything else. I think I can steal Edie out of this situation and get away with the loot. Look at the parameters he's...
He's on treating her like a trophy. It's another thing that he can take, compartmentalize and take with him.
Again, it's only what he's going after kind of thing.
Yeah. And so for her, I think that goodness of like, oh, he was this romantic guy, he was saving me off my feet, and now he's got this violent thing. And so right now, she's seeing this like dark side where he's just completely he's unashamed about who he is in that opening sequence that we saw in the previous scene. Where he comes in,
it's a kidnapping.
Yeah,
and this is, you know, distilled down.
Almost like a hostage.
Situation. Yeah.
This is the first time it goes bad. This is like in the relationship when it's the first push during an argument.
Yeah. Yes,
and the girl goes.
But the stakes. That's what I love is the relatability. Is this is the first big argument between a honeymoon a couple in a honeymoon is the period.
Crash back to reality.
But this is the crash back to reality. But the stakes of this reality are just so gargantuan compared to like, oh, I don't, you know, I'm an atheist, you know, I'm an atheist or whatever that argument is, or you know, like, no, I don't want to get our children baptized.
I've never seen Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I didn't care for it. Whoa, this is over.
So.
As opposed to this, which is like, there's a time factor on it where you know, you have to uproot your entire life in less than 24 hours after our first fight.
That's going to go down well. And so I think there's a certain fatalism about their relationship that I think is capitalized on here, but it's like, she's only seen literally a guy who is like the answer for her. Like, she's in love with him. Like, completely infatuated with him or taken with him over two visits. And now she's getting the darks and depths. And he's like, I will let you go. This is a mistake. This is, you know, I wanted to get out of here. It all went wrong, da da da. And you can see him pleading here.
But
and
it still feels like I hit you because I love you.
It does.
You want to grab her and be like,
girl,
get out of there.
Yeah. Like, well, that's why when she runs in the previous scene, it's the first thing in the movie where it's like, you've actually made the right choice in this one. Just get out.
And this is the thing you get with an epic of this length. When you're pushing 3 hours, there are a lot of avenues. There's, you know, from the Wangro as a serial killer to all these various little things we can go to.
Yes.
Mm. Even Van Sant is really like one of those avenues to go and explore. This is one that doesn't, like her running up the hill and it turning into a kidnapping is a little melodrama that I find is a bit at odds with the rest of the time.
I get that,
I just, and I sit there going, that doesn't feel like, I know this downward slide, this downhill slide is all the various snaps of the discipline.
Yes.
But this one just doesn't feel, it's so at odds with the Macaulay thing of like, this always reeks of desperation. Like,
oh, he doesn't that.
No, but why does he want her so badly? Just because it's a girl who.
But I think
is so good.
This is the tension. This is what that's great. It's all this is like fantasy Neil and real Neil, who we know, like the discipline Neil. And I think that this is why I like this. And this is like someone talked about like Michael Mann having a style similar to it was Brendan Hodges in an episode that you guys would have heard a couple of episodes ago, a great writer from Chicago, and he talked about him having an association between Mann and Michelangelo Antonioni. And he said because they both sometimes have got this amazing ability to be both like literal and metaphorical at the same time. And I think what's great in the context of the movie, and this is where I sort of, this one where I'm going to sort of cheat a little bit and talk about another minute while we're talking about this minute, I'm going to be Neil and break my discipline, is I always look at this refracted through that great dinner scene that happens earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Because the pure fact of it is, when we're running up to that dinner scene, what is Neil really appraising at that scene? He's looking around. He knows that Michael is just there for the juice. Fortunately, he's got Elaine. He's looking at, you know, so he's looking at Treo and Alice, and they're like new young love, whatever. Like, he doesn't care. They're just infatuated with each other. And he's looking at Chris and Charlene.
Straight after the affair.
He's orchestrated her to come back. Yeah. Straight after Chris has already been at his house in the morning talking about like a massive fight.
And he's out, and he knows Chris is out.
And he knows Chris is out with other girls. And he's there looking at this scene, and it is as futile and fleeting as Max looking at a fucking postcard of an island in Collateral. Like, it's just a fiction.
Yeah.
And so it's so cool. Like, why I look at this minute, and I think this is where I've come back to, continue with this minute and the previous scene, is like, this guy is so troublingly controlling to make sure that this vision, this fantasy comes true, that he's willing to fucking kidnap this chick in this scene. And that's why I get so like, this is why I'm like emphatic about this scene now, and why I'm growing more fond of how this construction happens, is because I think Edie has to reconcile with fantasy Edie too. Like, she has to go, she goes,
I get that. Yeah,
she reconciles later, and it happens in a much more overt way in other minutes. But in this minute, I like that we watch Neil stand there desperate to live fantasy instead of reality.
Well, I think it's a 12 monkeys quote. There's Mel and Stowe, so it's a very great in 12 Monkeys, which is about the Bruce Willis character, which is exactly applies to this situation, which is he lives in a meticulously constructed fantasy world, and that world is going to disintegrate right around him.
Yeah, that's exactly true, because it is crumbling.
Yeah,
I think he wants her in his life because it speaks to the power of her CD artwork as well.
Hey, there's some good emerging indie bands in New Zealand.
The digital age would go on to hit Edie quite hard when there was some time. Her work's now on.
But the question is then, how much of that goes to the blame for the lack of, this is an uncomfortable topic, how much of the blame goes on Edie in this situation?
There has to be. And I don't want to victim shame, because that's the worst thing. And this is, everything is kind of on fast forward in terms of, she's seen the monster.
Yeah.
She's tried to get away. He's literally captured her back. And then she's sort of got the Stockholm Syndrome, has like been fast forwarded up overnight. And when we started this minute, she does not look like she has slept a wink.
No.
Like, she is beaten down. He's looking frazzled as well. Because how are we? We're not that far from the scene of when he's put poor Trejo out of his... And that's a nighttime scene. So you get the sense that they've...
Yeah.
How long do we say it is since then? Maybe 12 hours, or maybe not, like...
No, it's all that the...
Because they go there at nighttime.
The Trejo Van Zandt, like, if Connor Ratliff, who has been on the show, is to be believed, and his theory of this movie takes place over 7 days, the Trejo follow-up, so leaving Val and Christian Hellas at the veterinary clinic or whatever it is.
Straight to
Trejo's.
Up to Van Zandt.
Yeah, calls Nate on the way to Van Zandt. After he murders Van Zandt, he's arriving at Edie's.
Okay, so this is potentially maybe because the hockey's on. Yes. So we're thinking maybe a nighttime game. So, yeah. So this is possibly 12 hours later or sunrise. This is maybe 6 a.m.
This is about 7 a.m. in LA.
So she hasn't slept a wink. Because he looks like he hasn't
he's still all over the place and he's about to send her out.
But he's one of those guys who'd be always on the, you know, has that kind of energy to just keep you out of it.
Yeah, but the sort of when
her... I don't know if we just let one piece of innuendo go through to the keepers there. I just want to make sure that when the three of us are doing a show, we can't let any of, like, this guy will keep you up all night stuff. Like, we can't just let that go.
Yeah, it's a bit improper. I dropped the ball, Colin. I'm sorry about that.
Wait, what is happening?
But this touching of the face, and it's this controlling attitude, and you can tell by her body language of, like, I want out. I'm not... Yeah. I despise you. Why are you still talk? Why? But it shows that the longer you stay, the more damage it's going to be done because you're going to trick yourself. Then the minute she says, like the moment she says, can I go later?
Yeah.
It's all over.
Yeah. Like, she's already making a compromise there.
You're now a mark.
Yeah. That's a wrinkle. That's it.
You've bought it. You've already put out last night that you got abused, physical abuse, and you've already put that behind you and the way she walks off without
dead fish.
No, but she doesn't, like, not that you would expect her to, but there's no addressing it. She just walks off and leaves it ambiguous. Yeah. And you take that back to the real world. You leave a touch of abuse against someone ambiguous and it goes for a couple of days and a couple of weeks. Then it happens again. That is your new reality again. You just live in that cycle of violence, which you would imagine that Chris and Charlene have their blues and the other people of the crew, you get the sense that they'd have those outbursts.
But they're all very, very different relationships. That's the whole thing that with Edie's character is that she's not only the most sympathetic, but she wears a heart on the sleeve. She's like almost naive.
She's the baby.
And that's why you have the next scene after this with Venora, who's the complete opposite.
She is in terms of blousy, controlling. She's controlling her own scenario.
But Edie's the only person, except for maybe Natalie Portman's character, but Edie's the only partner who doesn't know what she's in. Everyone else knows what they do.
Oh, everyone else is. And everyone is fully aware.
And everyone
turns
a blind eye. Yeah. She's a babe in the woods.
Yeah.
You really see how
she hasn't made the conscious choice.
How quickly she gets sucked in, which is kind of sad to see. One of the best payoffs is obviously the walking away from the car. That look when De Niro gives her that look of like, "Sorry, I'm out." And the way she sort of comes out of it like a dream, like,
"Yes,
what am I?" She sort of comes to at the airport with sirens going off.
When she's sitting in the car.
But it's when people are running out of the hotel. She sort of comes to going,
What am I doing?
You can almost imagine her on the phone to her own mother sort of going, it's the dumbest thing. I know this guy's killed people. He kidnapped me and we were going to fly to New Zealand here. Like, what? And it's...
I wouldn't imagine her on the phone because she's betrayed like him and she's sort of a loner herself.
Oh, yeah. You get that. But I just say, like, she has this sort of... awakening that performance because she sort of goes into the stupor here when she sort of sinks in because from here on in she's not really, I think she pretends to be more engaged, especially in the car, like she sort of gets that like,
well,
we're going but
there's sort of a really significant minute coming up and it's at about, you know, it's about 4 minutes away
when he gets the Jamison call.
Yeah,
she's still on board with that time.
absolutely there's some significant stuff that happens where they're standing on, you know, this beautiful sort of vista and the night sky is lit up behind them and they're next to this really interesting tree and Neil's begging her, like it's another turning point. It's like she's been with him throughout the entire day. She's seeing that they are Neil is making all the moves to escape. It's almost like it's reaffirming all the things that right now are just completely nothing. She's not registering any of the things that he's saying. She's just like going through the motion. She's in a state of shell shock.
And her world's crumbling too. Because remember, she only thinks he's a metal salesman up till this point.
I mean, how are they going to find a place in New Zealand with as good a glass to stick her CD out with?
Exactly.
It's just...
No domain back then. You're going to do it like door to door.
Door to door. There weren't even printers in New Zealand in 95.
They didn't even have light down there. Until Weta put it in. Not many people know that. They built it from scratch.
Peter Jackson and Weta made the whole country.
He installed the sun.
I know. I know. It might be news to you, but it's, you know.
That is actually the way this scene is shot. Aside from this shot, which we're looking at, most of the scene you have this bright, bright white light just flooding. This is a big bay window scene.
Yes.
Which is like almost a complete contrast to the De Niro when he's alone in the moonlight.
That looks more like
earlier in the film.
Recent sort of Spielberg stuff.
Yeah, it's like, he's going on to the Close Encounters ship.
Yeah. But that's like sort of Bridge of Spies, sort of recent, sort of really bright white.
Just flooded in light,
And in this scene, I think it's, you know, the cold, you know, this scene is, you know, if I had to name it, I'd call it the cold light of day scene. Like, this is Neil at his very worst, and it's kind of like the curtain back on him, and I think that that's what... I also think it goes to adding a layer of discomfort for us, but I think it's like necessary discomfort for Neil, because there's a certain extent where we're just sitting here, we've been watching this guy, we've been watching him do everything, and one thing that I really like about Michael Mann actually talking about Neil is like, oh, Neil's a sociopath. You know, I want you to empathize with him, because we can empathize with, especially cinematic and gangster movie sociopaths. Like, we sort of have an affinity with them because we can understand their motivations. They protect their families. There's a lot of likable qualities in their professionalism or whatnot. But in this moment, this is like, you know, him with the claws in, like in the previous scene, it's like, for me, I call it like the lion and the gazelle. It's like literally like this nocturnal attack. Like, she runs away, she's flailing, she's got this like fur-like hair that's flailing in the wind, and they run through the tall bending grass, like Maliki grass.
But I think, as you've said on this, I think all sympathy for him's out the window post the heist.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
We're in a new reality. We've redefined the reality now. We have no, like, now we want him hunted.
Yes.
Like, we're, and we look at her, especially, there's something to her performance, and there's something about, she has in this the look of someone that sort of feeling when you stay up all night and your skin almost feels taut. Yes. Like, you sort of feel like you don't know what it is, why you can't, your hair's a bit like she
feels
like,
greasy.
Yeah, just everything like, doesn't, and she's got that here where she's, it's not quite... It's like sort of if you've had like there's like two beer sort of buzz, that you're a bit sort of out of it.
And I know. I think it's more a case of, as you were saying, this is an indication that she's had previous maybe abuse and past relationships.
You're right.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Why that's why she stays.
And so it's this case where she's almost automatically just like switches off, like almost just.
I think this is her first time. I think she's really? I think she's bewildered. Like, I don't know whether Amy Brenneman actually asked Michael Mann a question about the character originally, saying, oh, this chick's fucked up. Like, has she been abused or something as a child? And Mann's answer was like, no, she just loves him. And so I think that maybe
it feels a bit...
But maybe, like, his conception of the character was that, no, this is like a lonely person who's come from out of town. This is like the most... LA, this transient town, brings in people from people, like backwater towns. Make connections. She's desperate.
Plus, she's coming from a very artsy... She's coming from an educated arts background.
Yes.
Yeah. And they had a somewhat of a, like, a romantic meet cute as well. Mm-hmm. Like, in terms of...
Lady...
what's it to you?
What do you care about what I'm reading or what I do?
It's like the most gruff Nancy Myers movie.
Oh, fucking bring on 20 gruff Nancy Myers movies.
But like, she's
all of them with Keanu Reeves winning at the end.
They're trading. Like, you get the sense that she's had thought way more about Neil, because he doesn't even know she exists till... that scene...
She is more invested in the relationship.
Well, he cocks a look when she says, I've seen you. Where have you seen me? She's clocked him before he's clocked her.
Mm. Yeah.
So she's already built up somewhat she's built up somewhat of a feeling towards him, even if it's friendly or whatnot. And that's why she makes the sort of first move.
See you in the store from time to time.
Yeah. Hello.
All right.
Metal books. Fills out those trousers quite nicely. Yeah, so you get the
tungsten in your pocket.
So she gets all that part. Then she gets
that tungsten in your pocket.
How good's their first date as well?
Yeah.
Their first date goes from, like, you know, putting weird cream in your coffee that happens to be on a weird bench somewhere, into a dinner, into drinks, into
cream in your coffee,
into
an origami napkin.
But this is quite the shock when, you know, she's probably still dealing with the heist as well.
Yeah, I think she's real. Like, I think it can never be understated. I think this is a great you know, opportunity when you're recontextualizing a movie like 24 years after. It's like, we're so goddamn accustomed to like whole news channels and every outlet has a 24 hour something, something, something. And right now, this is like when it exists. Like, this is when it came into, it essentially just came into fruition at this time. And so it's like this 24 hour news cycle, how much that would batter your psyche to see someone who you've had a fantasy about and they're literally living out a fantasy life and then you're watching them be a murderer and a bad guy.
But also, there's no real... Just to refresh my memory, there's no way that she knows what's happened. He hasn't...
She just hasn't seen him in days.
Yeah, but she doesn't really...
He hasn't even... He said, I'm going to go away soon.
She watches on the news. She's at home in her studio, isn't she?
Yeah, so the context setting scene, pre-heist, there's three great cutaways.
Remember, does she put it to him that he's actually involved? Why does she run from memory?
Walks in and she goes...
Was that you?
Was that... She's like... Was that you?
Yeah, that's right.
Was that you? Like, she can't even believe that it's him.
Yeah.
And he goes, I tell you what I don't do. I don't sell medals. What an asshole. It's like a dick move.
Listen, I have to clear something. I know you might be wondering what this is going to do to my medal sales once word of this gets out. I'm just going to put your mind at ease. I don't do that.
I don't send that.
Oh, I'm so good. I'm so glad Mr. Johnson down at the metal store would have been so disappointed when he found out about this. Yeah, so I don't like him in this scene, especially making the, like...
The hands.
Bridging the gap, physical. Because the way he's touching her, it's a very tender, caressing sort of way, and it's instantly bringing those hooks are going
in.
Yeah,
the hooks.
Yeah. Because she... Like from
it's very uncomfortable.
Well, the first question is, when is this over?
Yeah,
and then it's like, oh, baby, okay, all right. When can I go? Can I go later? And in that, in just that simple, like simple writing of like, we've now moved. You're now back in the cage.
I think one thing we need to talk about is like, he's occupying her space. He's essentially using this as a like as a safe house because no one knows about their relationship. So it's like, you can go now. But you get the sense that he's not leaving that house. She's going to run errands or whatever. He's not leaving that house until he has to go to Nate's.
Yeah, but as kidnappings go, in your own house is the most convenient. Like,
home court. You keep it most docile.
Or home court advantage.
Yeah.
I would have loved the Home Alone-esque spin-off.
But that's not a surprise for him at all.
No.
In terms of his character. No. Doing that, he uses, you know, he basically exploits every avenue he does.
Well, he doesn't have anyone over to the beach house.
No.
Surely. There's no furniture. No.
Except for Chris.
Yeah. What's he going to give him? Like, he's going to make coffee?
It's just, but it's her, though. It's like, I know a bunch of people who work as graphic designers and shit in Los Angeles and stuff. If he was coming into that door, they would have said, get the fuck out of my house.
That's 2019,
but... No, I'm talking about people like, you know, from back then.
In the words of Dave Chappelle, gay people are really brave. Like, way braver than straight white people.
Oh, I'm talking about some chicks I know in Los Angeles, too.
Yeah. So nothing. No one has more mental fortitude than a young gay man, especially a young gay designer. Get the fuck out of my house! They're like brave as shit. The kick out of bank robber. I would have gone.
He's never painted her. There's one thing I do like. She's not meek.
No.
Oh, I don't. Like, I don't know. I'd agree with that.
Really?
I just think she's.
I think it's just. I don't think it's necessarily in because of what he's.
Because how does it... I mean, he writes... In terms of how he writes female characters, that's a good question.
Well, I don't think he's...
He writes...
So like, meek, like, literal definition is, you know, sort of quiet and gentle and easily imposed on. So the challenge...
I take that back. Yeah. Maybe she's very meek.
No, I don't know. No, but the challenge is...
She's not weak, but she is... Yeah, I would say
I said meek.
You said, you've got your M&Ws for sure.
I don't know what you're hearing. But I clearly said no, but there's just maybe something about that. The fact that she does try to run as well. Her first instinct is one to try and she's saying, "When can I go?" So she does have, That's what I mean. She has agency. Some agency in that sense. So she's not just sitting there going, "Okay."
But isn't but aren't the best abusers the best thing like that? That they make the victim think they have agency?
Well, exactly.
He's saying you go, you've got a choice.
Yeah.
It's almost like clean up, go home. Like, you've got a choice, but she doesn't have a choice.
We've been getting, I mean, for our work purposes, you know, people, I've been watching this, the Jacko doco called Leaving Neverland about Michael Jackson's thing, and it's all about how pedophiles and that kind of stuff and the kind of things we're using they weren't using threats or anything like that. It was all about emotional dependence, codependency, and all these sort of tactics in terms
of... off the back of the grooming and everything.
Yeah, like all the grooming stuff and going into the details of that sort of stuff. And you can see, actually...
Far more insane.
Looking back at, you know, look at the heat and some of it, you see... Not about pedophiles, of course, but about controlling within any sort of relationship and the power dynamic. And
sure.
Stuff. And totally applies in this case.
On the limited scope that we have of the film, Edie doesn't have anyone else. Everyone else everyone else, Justine has her, she's got Ralph or she's got other things. All the other wives have their own distractions and whatnot. Mm. She doesn't have anything like... Every time we see her, she's perched up in the house, and he's calling her. She's there.
But I think
it's also a big mistake to assume that someone who chooses to live alone or that immediately emotionally weak. Or
saying that.
I think she's just completely. I don't know if it's caught by surprise, but I think it's just completely blindsided, and she's just reeling. I think she's kind of emotionally off balance, and I think that you guys both, we just talked about it. I think Stu actually said the words of like, you feel like she comes out of a dream as this progresses, as she's believing the lie of Neil being willing to escape.
Oh, because it's absurd. It's the absurdity.
But she's believing the lie.
But it's a nice fantasy also, I guess.
Believing the fantasy. She's believing the lie because they're heading to the airport. They're doing the thing. They're talking to Nate on the phone. It's all happening. And even on the pit stop, I think she doesn't quite know what the hell's going on because if you're listening on the other end of the phone, there's nothing in the car that says, yes, I'm going to kill this person. Nate goes, you asked, so I've got to tell you, that guy who you asked for is in the so-and-so hotel, under the name Jameson. And he's like, yeah. And you see him going through his own, realization moment and determination moment. It's another, really impactful moment in the film. And when he actually does that, like you said, that's when almost the veil comes off. Like when he pulls that car off and she's like, where are we going? He's like, I just got to make a pit stop. I'll make time.
But you think there was any, before this scene, do you think from her there was any level of willful blindness?
No.
At all?
Oh, no, sorry. Like she's willfully like just living in fantasy land? Yes. As soon as she says...
No, but is she willfully ignoring sort of the signs that other people...
Well, it comes and goes. I don't get to see...
Yeah, the thing of the conversations, that kind of thing.
No, I think in the first... So their first couple of times, they're just like hot dates, whatever, a couple of like essentially two one-night stands in a row. Well, like you don't need to get to know them.
And remember, don't underestimate how much he's putting on the mysterious. He's got the mystique happening as well, where you don't get a sense. He's all wanting to know about her.
Yeah. Yes.
Where are you from? Where are your family? And she goes, she asks him, he's like, oh, what a brother I don't see anymore, family. She's a bit older. Why is she going to question... He's not readily...
Yeah, as long as he just doesn't end up like, Jackie L. Haley and Little Children. He ends up like masturbating in the car.
But I think what you say is like having the fantasy versus reality. I think so many times man skillfully breaks the fantasy, even of like cops and robbers.
Yes.
So we see the other side of the cops. We see in the first heist, like the breaking of the fantasy is the killing.
Yes. Yeah.
This thing is going beautifully and then... break reality, here's a gun, what, you want to fuck with me? And then we go, all those like sort of,
get broken into reality by Wayne Grove's fucking kill fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. There's the...
Just because one man can't keep it in his pants. That's always the way.
There's a few like that. There's a few like seeing how even the heist itself does that. And when the cops start getting killed, be like when Bosco gets shot, you're like...
Oh, when you see his death mask, that is a wake up
But call. You're like, oh, wait, that's right, we're not just riding in saving the day. This thing bites back.
Yes.
And that it shatters that fantasy. We see, someone's got to go tell his wife.
Yes.
And this is just another fantasy breaking where she's sort of coming to... Justine's is a bit as well. I think Justine's is the conversation...
Is the rough after,
No, I think it's the breaking is the...
Oh, the conversation.
After dinner when he was meant to go home. That's her realisation when that wall's coming all in.
Can we just talk about like from a formal standpoint, the body language of the disgust of him reaching out to kiss her 38 seconds into this minute and her pulling away and then him leaning his head towards it and her just jarring her head to the side and her face looks like he's a corpse.
It is
an absolutely utterly perfect performance.
Well, that kind of,
and like she stands up and she's again. The second time,
to avoid, yeah,
And around this time, when was something like Once Were Warriors? That would have been early 90s. Once Were Warriors,
92, I think.
Yeah, so that's when we had real, obviously, visceral domestic violence on screen. Yeah. But at times we saw...
Well, they wouldn't know.
94, America. 94, we saw, very close. We and it was a 1990 novel it was based on.
And we saw Morning After, when Jake would come into the kitchen, like the whole eggs situation. But his partner in that would have that, like, you did... Like, there is that same sort of look. And obviously the violence in one is so much worse than this. He's only sort of tackled her and brought it. But he still kidnapped her or detained her.
Yeah. Detained her.
But that look of just how much she conveys so well. I mean, on our podcast, we're always looking at, like...
Great podcast.
Thank you.
Cinephiles. both Garth and I have guested it on Stu's show. He frequently cheats on the show by coming on this one.
We look at the actresses that didn't get their time. So many times we see the male counterparts that probably got more of a career than they deserved, and they got 7 or 8 bites at the cherry to make it work.
Yeah, whereas women don't.
Amy Brenneman, are you always going, wow, did we see her enough? Did we see, like...
Well, she went to television and became self-produced.
She would pop up in different things. She was in that Stallone movie, Daylight, which was actually not that bad. And NYPD Blue was the big thing.
Yeah, but you feel like...
NYPD Blue, and then she did Judging Amy, where she's a producer and made a mozza for many years.
Oh, sure, but just that you feel like this performance is just could have been more...
Look
of
at
like
Ashley Judd. Look at Ashley Judd as well. Diane Venora is the one that went along, but you get people like Amy Brenneman and you get people like Ashley Judd, and you're like... Where the hell did you go?
I even say people, not to go way off, but someone like a Sharon Stone, didn't quite get the like some big high points,
of the three sort of female leads. Judd was a juggernaut back in the late 90s. She was she would open movies.
Oh, Double Jeopardy
things
time.
Things like, Kiss the Girls. She was big.
Then, obviously, we know now that she's gone,
Well, there, things happen, that kind of stuff, the Weinstein stuff.
Yeah.
Not pretty.
But I just feel like that is such a gripping way she just portrays that, from the look down all the way to the storm out, and just to leave him.
And I love this, because we're like 11 seconds to go in this minute, and man leaves us with Neil. Like, standing. So if we talk about Neil looking out to these beautiful vistas and, you know, looking out to the beautiful water. Right now, he's got the LA skyline, the smog covered
skyline. That's real LA skyline.
This is real LA, unceremonious, like LA skyline. And he's there, sort of standing there, and he's not looking out to the sublime right now. He's looking inward. He's inside the fishbowl. He's looking back at this domesticity. He's looking back at disgusted with him.
And he looks. She said
this is on Sunset Plaza. This is. Now prime real estate territory.
Yeah. But he looks... Manola Dargis put it best, and I think it was the 60th minute we talked about. You know, if we're talking about man and this movie being really authentic, and then we got to discussions about Edie's house, and she said, we allow some directors their fantasies.
Yeah, you know? No struggling artist could afford that.
The real estate fantasy is
just... She said she had I was listening to it before, and she has the excuse it's like an old house that needs work, and that's why she can afford having this great place in Los Angeles.
I can't stress how good the artwork was. Just a few CD covers and you've made it, baby. You've made it. But this is the first time we see Neil really shocked. Yes. He's not in control.
No.
He's, apart from being a kidnapper, but he just feels like she's...
It's not the same disciplined guy we've become accustomed to in this movie. His
tie off. We usually have the... Yeah.
It's him standing there. What a minute.
What a place to do some writing. Oh, yeah, you have a place like that.
I do have a place like that. It's just like, look at the sea, look at the ocean.
Okay.
Get a place in LA. Like that. That'd be nice. I'd come
There's one place I looked at, like, around that area that actually looked really nice. I wanted to get it, and the trouble is, it cost me $4.3 million. I didn't have that money.
Yeah, but that's in, like, 95 money. No, you get that for a steal. That's a cool 7.
That's a cool 7. I don't know where. A
couple more appearances on this show.
Is there any Highline burglaries around Garth's area that have mystified us? Because I don't know if he's going to get that cheeky $7 million to buy this house.
Well, the other big thing is the running scene before, because I've had a couple of friends who live up in the area. So this is Hollywood Hills above near Mulholland, looking down.
Please tell me they're reenacted just on weekends.
The whole thing is, they always say, anyone who lives up in the area, you do not go running on those hills and those grasses, because it's like, it is so geologically unstable.
Ah.
It is so, you know, cause it's just basically just loose dirt, alluvial dirt, or just crumble underneath it, like quicksand. There's like so many things living in little like scrubs and brushes and snakes.
And you just mean like just, lawyers and stuff.
No, 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 no. Yeah. You basically don't go outside your fence house.
Yeah, that's why you have
if you do, you go out on the road.
That's why you have a gated community. It sort of like keeps all the riffraff out. No, it's an interesting little minute. I'm not.
And up that way, you also have what they call the cum trees.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There are trees. I don't know what kind. It's like some sort of exotic flower that blooms every spring, but it smells like freshly produced cinnamon.
Sure, sure.
You just drive past it. For a couple of
this blocks. Is it's, a fact I was it, not just, expecting.
It is an unusual thing. You walk past, you're like, whore. Someone's having fun.
Well, that's one reason to...
It's this sort of minute.
Yeah. I can't remember
the name. This minute took a turn.
Yeah.
That in was... the end. And Stu's wiping his eye right now. And
I really don't know where to take that.
We're not going to take it anywhere. We're going to leave it right there.
Just leave that.
We're going to leave that lingering in the air.
I'll look up the name of that flower for a few minutes.
Maybe that's the look on Neil's face at the moment. Maybe he's just caught a whiff of that coming off the breeze as he's going,
oh. Out of the smog. So, from out of the smog to into the smog, ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of One Hit Minute. My wonderful guests, Stuart Coote, Garth Franklin, have joined me once again. Garth Franklin, the oldest running and highest integrity movie news website on the internet, Dark Horizons. Go there every day, multiple times.
Our site is the inverse of that.
And... Oh, here it is.
What found
is
the tree. Found sure. the tree. It's yeah. called the ornamental pear tree.
Oh, we're going on pear. With this.
Caleri pear.
We're going deeper. No.
Caleri pear is sure. tree in the US. Sure.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
But it's funnily enough, it's an Australian tree. Go to show.
Oh, there you go.
Australian spreading come all over yeah. the Los Angeles.
Have happens. You done a little self-edits to the wiki page or this? Just in recent updates.
That was the fastest self-edit of a wiki page I've ever seen.
Homer come the monk. Oh, yeah.
Stu Coote, guys, as you know, because you've listened to the show before, and if you haven't, welcome. Yeah. Thank you for listening. Stu is 1/3 of the tripod of the Cinephiles podcast with Josh and Liam. It is an absolute ball. These guys go through their cinematic sins for a whole stack of different movies, and I've heard it teased that I may be doing an appearance on a future episode of... recapping Blown Away starring Tommy Lee Jones yes. and Jeff Bridges.
Yes,
a film that I brought to Stu's
Sloth
attention
for me.
Sloth
so, yes
Sloth has it? Never
yeah.
seen it.
Ah, okay. I haven't seen it, but I'm not sure if it quite gets over the hurdle of classic, but I'm happy to come
best
to
movie on. Made best movie made best. In 94 don't at me.
I was so angry.
I mean, it got described to me as if Tommy Lee Jones survived under siege.
Yes, it is. It is. Actually, adventures. That's true. That actually
and
fits
I
the
am
description.
So in.
Yes. It's good. And also inherited Richard Gere's terrible Irish accent from The Jackal.
Or Brad Pitt's from Devil's Own.
Yeah. Yes.
Jackal.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of One Heat Minute with these two maniacs, and it's been an absolute pleasure having you along. I can thank him in person, Garth Franklin, for our web design. Mr. Paul Davies, thank you for our theme, and thank you guys for listening, and you can go now. You can go. I'm going to let you go, but I don't know if I'm going to let you go later.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.